From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking about staged satire of Utah's predominant culture, the first thing you think of is the annual presentation of Saturday's Voyeur by the Salt Lake Acting Company. But there are others who use these themes in their work. For an audience, there's a kind of perverse comfort in seeing puritanical bullies and intolerant hypocrites getting skewered. Today in the program, we're talking about the risks and rewards of this kind of satire. Are there limits to this kind of art? Are the old stock characters of fleshy white guys in ill-fitting suits all that interesting anymore, or really even accurate? What are the new characters, the new themes and stories that reflect a Utah culture in the 21st century? How do you reflect this reality and keep it funny? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Utah satire, there are certain stock characters. It's not really all that different from the types and masks used in early theater. You've got your puffy white Mormon legislator in an ill-fitting suit toting around a massive Big Gulp. He's fervent and a little dim. You have the stock portrayal of a Relief Society president, big hair, floral dress. She tends to have a prescription drug issue and carry around a casserole. You have the Utah accent, the Utah names, the green jello, the repressed gay guy. As one of our guests today pointed out, these stereotypes serve as a reference point to connect an audience to a story and to bigger themes, and sometimes they work. They take the piss out of the powerful and the smug, but they don't always work. Today in the program, we're talking about how you portray Utah culture in art. We're focusing on plays today, but there are other forms, of course, where all of this plays out. Today, we're asking if the older stereotypes are still working or if they are played out now. The playwright Miguel Santana is among our guests today. He's turned his experience into a play about Mormon housewives. He'll join us with others to talk about the challenges of putting Utah culture on stage. We are going to begin, though, with Sister Dottie Dixon. Charles Lynn Frost created and plays the character Sister Dottie Dixon. She's a faithful Latter-day Saint, a proud mother of a gay son named Donnie. It all began as a radio series on KRCL. Frost has co-created and performed two full-length one-woman shows. He now appears regularly on X96's Radio from Hell for a segment called What Would Sister Dottie Do? And we spoke with Charles Frost earlier this morning. He explained the differences that he sees between a stereotype and a satire.
I think a piece of satire has a message behind it. I think parody, satire, farce, high comedy, all those top end of the comedy spectrum types of pieces that a writer chooses to write or a company chooses to produce, you have something you really want to say, and you're really careful in what that is that you want to say, because you're choosing a medium in theater or film wherein you've got to be really selective, in my opinion. And a stereotype, to me, I guess it's, so what's new? Tell me something that I don't already know. If you're commenting on something, or you're taking a broad slap at something, and you're not giving me anything new to think about, then perhaps that stereotype might get a chuckle out of me, or it might make me laugh at something that I'm already fully aware of. Whereas I think a parody or a satire, like I say, a farce, is making a huge comment in the comedic world about something that needs to be discussed or enlightened.
Is there or was there a bit of anger at the heart of your early portrayals of Sister Dottie, for example? Anger at the dominant culture for the way it was treating gay people or vulnerable people who didn't fit into these conventional niches? I mean, I'm wondering how it's evolved. Did it start with something a little bit less nuanced, maybe a little bit more defiant or angry, and then change over time?
Yeah, I think it started much more simple, and it's become much more complex. I don't know that anger was ever there. I think there was, Sister Dottie, her big mantra has always been, I stand firmly on the side of love. You don't have to choose your church over your child, family preservation and acceptance is not even a question. Of course, you keep your family together and you love unconditionally. So that was a pretty simple thesis that she started with. And then the themes with which, you know, she evolved in the first play that Troy Williams and I wrote, and then the second play that Krister Wixom and I wrote. You've got to be really careful. I mean, you grab a thesis and you hold on to it firmly, and then you choose your themes really carefully, and you're going to have to weave those themes like a thread through a tapestry, and they're going to have to come out with some sort of answers for your audience. And then the topics that you throw onto the table should evoke some evolution in people's thought or in their thinking or who they are or what they perceive. And so the complexities of the second play were much greater as far as those themes that we threw down on the table than the first play. But the first play was always around love, not anger or hate. Yeah, it was, please just accept and love your children and take away judgment and some shame and some blame. And, you know, let's remove the fear. And then we have something to work with when it comes to a model of parenting and helping people to become healthy, happy adults.
What's your sense, Charles, of the satire that's playing out in Utah right now? Because you've talked about how you're a little tired of some of the easy targets, so I'm guessing you see it done well, and I'm guessing you see stuff that's a little tiresome.
At times, I do. I do. I think I have to go back as, you know, an actor, writer, director, and go, okay, purpose. What's the purpose of this? And if it's to be a huge fundraiser for, say, a theater company to fund the duration of their season, and if people want to go and just laugh and be amongst a lot of other progressive liberals and yuck it up and, you know, have some fun at the expense of the predominant culture here or the limited thinking here. I don't necessarily think it's the LDS culture so much as it is the uber-conservative culture that we sometimes go and laugh about, then that has a purpose behind it. Is it high theater? No. I mean, for me, it's not Molière. I mean, Molière was a genius when he wrote, like, The Imaginary Invalid or Tartuffe, and he took upon the clergy and the church, and he took on some big topics, but the whole time he was laughing at them with these ridiculous characters who bought into a lot of that. But that's a farce, too. Molière wrote farce.
Yeah.
You look at some of the great tragedic writers of our modern time, you know, Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, I think The Crucible is a tragedy. But, you know, again, he focuses on hypocrisy and judgment and drives it home brilliantly with some amazing characters in a period piece, which was really commenting on a contemporary piece, the McCarthy trial.
Right.
So,
right.
The genius.
You say it's time to move forward. Who's moving forward? Who are the playwrights or the actors or the directors who are, you think, sort of pushing us forward?
Locally?
Yeah.
I have to take my hat off to Jerry Rapier at Plan B. I think Jerry always pushes the envelope. He encourages new writers. I really am quite thrilled that he's devoted an entire season to Eric Samuelson next year. I think Eric, as a playwright, creates really interesting characters. I would love to see Eric's characters take greater risks sometimes, but I think they are there. Julie Jensen, she writes some amazing pieces too. I think Kathleen Cahill, she's writing, in my opinion, the best theater locally right now, and much of which could go nationally. I thought her charm 2 seasons ago at Sala Casting Company blew me away. I mean, it put the transcendentalists under a microscope, and their male patriarchy and hierarchy against a female writer, and juxtaposed all that and tossed it up and made it a brilliant piece of theater. She's got a really solid voice. And I think Slack tries to read new plays. I like Acting Company. And I really appreciate the fact that they give such attention and detail to a new play and a new writer. You go to one of their play reading series, it's just as serious as if you're going to a production there. And they treat you with the same amount of respect and dignity that is deserved of all the hard work that a writer goes through in kind of wringing that piece of literature out of themselves.
You said that we should be making those deeper themes more poignant, but also, you told us earlier this week, also more hilarious. So it's still okay to be funny. This is okay to be funny with some of these things.
I think so, Doug. I mean, I think comedy is the best way to get people to change. Sure, drama, sure, tragedy, you know, those are amazing pieces of the theater and genres, but comedy and hilarity, if you can get people laughing and then 1 minute later, you know, kind of holding back some tears, going, oh my gosh, I was just laughing, and here I am now ready to weep, and it's all about that same scene I just watched. Therein lies a lot of power, but that's what really, I think really great or good theater does, is it takes you on that journey to feel all of those feelings. But laughter is the best medicine. It's also the hardest. I mean, you've heard this, and I'm sure your listeners have, that, you know, comedy's a science. It's not an art. I mean, it's a science. It's so hard. And that's why we right-brainers who dare to touch upon comedy, we realize that, you know, just respect the science of that, because you don't have a lot of liberty to go one way or another. Comedy has a formula.
Final question. When do you know you've gone too long? When the joke is played out?
I think you've gone too long when, again, if the play has very little to say that's new, then I think you've wasted people's time. I think you have to talk about new ideas, and you have to talk about new ways of approaching how we interact as human beings. And if you're just regurgitating some of the stuff on the news, yeah, to me that's tedious. You've fallen into what I call the kitchen sink trap. You've taken on too many topics, and you're just muddling around. So you got to be really selective and careful.
It's Charles Lynn Frost. He co-created and performs Sister Dottie S. Dixon. We invite you to join us, by the way, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. We should also mention we invited the writers of Salt Lake Acting Company's Saturday's Voyeur to join us today. Nancy Borgnicht conceived of that annual project back in 1978. She's overseas this week, couldn't join us. Alan Nevins has been writing for it for the past 20 years or so. He declined to join us since he's deep in the writing process right now. This year's production premieres June 26th. The director, Cynthia Fleming, did not feel like she could speak on behalf of that writing team, so she declined to join us as well. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Ben Fulton. He is a theater, books, and arts reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, also served as the editor of the City Weekly for nearly 4 years. So he's been writing about this stuff for a long time. Ben, welcome back.
Hi, Doug.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Troy Williams is with us, producer and host of KRCL's Radioactive. It's a weekly issues-oriented talk program on KRCL. In 2009, he co-wrote the play, The Passion of Sister Dottie S. Dixon, along with Charles Frost. He also appeared in Errol Morris's documentary Tabloid. You probably saw him there, which features a number of characters from Mormon culture. And Troy Williams, welcome back to you.
Thanks.
We also have Eric Samuelson, a playwright, director, and critic. He has retired now as the head of the playwriting program at Brigham Young University. And we should mention Plan B Theater Company is devoting their 2013-14 season to his work. And Eric, welcome back to you.
Good to be here, Doug.
We also have Miguel Santana with us, a novelist and a playwright. The Righteous and Very Real Housewives of Utah County is currently being staged here in Salt Lake City. It's also the basis for his fourth novel of the same name. We'll give you more details about that play as we go along. But Miguel Santana, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So I guess I wanted to start with Saturday's Voyeur, because that seems to be sort of the most iconic when we're talking about staged productions that skewer Utah
sure.
culture. How important was Saturday's Voyeur, really? Because it seems to have been the first one to kind of break the ice in some ways. Eric?
Oh, back to the late 70s, I think it was immensely important. I think it launched a lot of sort of Mormon self-examination, and I think it was nice to see something where we could laugh at ourselves and laugh at our own culture. It was what I might call sort of outsider satire, and it seemed to be written by people who are not within the culture,
yeah.
criticizing it from that outsider's point of view. I think within the culture, I think it was seen kind of defensively. How dare they make fun of us like this? But about the same time, that late 70s period, James Arrington was touring with his Farley Family piece.
Yeah, Farley Family Reunion.
That's right, the first Farley Family Reunion. And that was sort of insider satire with somebody who was in the culture making fun of it. And I think those two things happening about the same time kind of opened up the door to being able to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah. What do you guys think? What the importance of Saturday's Voyeur in that time? It was the first time we all started laughing about this stuff.
Well, I remember it from when I was a teenager, and my folks took me to see it.
And is that right?
Yes. But I remember it. It was very interesting because I was raised more or less evangelical Protestant. My stepdad was a Catholic. And even though my mother had theological differences with the Mormons, she really didn't enjoy the play. But I think Saturday's Voyeur was important in that it broke the taboo of always being taught that religion and politics are two things you don't discuss in polite society. And Saturday's Voyeur said, well, perhaps we don't discuss this in polite society, but we can discuss it in an entertaining context. And that really broke the ice in Salt Lake City and throughout the culture and beyond theater, I think, even. So in that sense, it was extremely important.
Yeah. Actually, Charles Frost took me to Voyeur for the first time, and it was right in that period of my life when I was just kind of coming out of Mormonism, coming out of the closet, and it was explosive to see. You won't find a more talented, passionate, creative cast than the cast of Saturday's Voyeur. And so it was wonderful to have that experience. It was a breath of fresh air that opened up my mind at the time to new possibilities.
But what was that seems to be, I think, an important dynamic of the people who go to see Saturday's Voyeur mm-hmm. time after time after time, because in some ways, and this may get to an important dynamic of the importance of satire, for someone who feels repressed ideologically
right.
or sexually or whatever
right.
it happens to be, it's a huge opportunity to be able to sort of let your guard down, I guess, and laugh at the people that have been bullying you, I guess, in some ways, right?
And for our Mormon listeners, please take this the right way. Sometimes blasphemy is so healthy and therapeutic. Sometimes it's okay to muddle the sacred and the profane together, because through the mixture of the two, you discover a lot of truths about culture, about community, about ourselves. And being brave enough to walk in to blasphemy, I think, is a sign of a really spiritually mature person.
It's also empowering. I mean, one of the things about satire is it is the art form of the powerless against the powerful.
Yes. Yeah.
Power is a huge dynamic.
It's
here,
a
right?
huge dynamic. It's tremendously important. And so with Voyeur, you were exploding that nexus of both religious power and religious orthodoxy and the importance of that, and then political power
right.
within the state. So I think for a lot of the audiences, I think that was a lot of it. It was incredibly empowering.
Yeah.
It felt like there are other people out here who are feeling as oppressed as I am, who are feeling as marginalized as I am.
Well, as a newcomer to the community, last year was the first time that I saw it, and I was very impressed, and I was completely, completely, it felt therapeutic, it felt... I mean, having grown up LDS in Mexico, I had a totally different perception of this community. So
that was a big deal for you.
It was a big deal for me.
Yeah,
it was amazing. I couldn't stop laughing all the way through.
See, so interesting here, because I think, Miguel, one of the things that's going to be interesting as we sort of talk more about the particulars of your play is you're kind of a newcomer to this. I mean, you know, most of us here can talk about Saturday's Voyeur having some kind of institutional memory of the fact that they've been doing it for a long time. And one of the questions is also, and not just for Saturday's Voyeur, but how much these stereotypes are resonating today, whether they're a little played out, a little boring, a little tiresome at this point, which we'll get to. But your insights, Miguel Santana, as kind of a newcomer to all of this, you're not really seeing them as played out. You're experiencing some of these stereotypes that you sort of take on in a new way.
Exactly. This is it's a whole new take on the community that I grew up believing that it was a promised land. You know, being a kid in Mexico, going to church, Utah was always the ideal. I wanted to be here. I wanted to see how Mormons, I wanted to be a Mormon. I wanted to be part of this community.
Yeah.
So it took a few years to get here. But now, as 2 years ago, when my partner and I moved here, all these what so-called stereotypes or types that you are commenting on being exploited or being seen too much in theater, from the perspective from someone outside from Utah, they're not really, local playwrights are local playwrights, you know, and these themes are used and reused and recycled. But for outside of Utah, to say that people know that an icon of Mormonism is the Relief Society president with a prescription pill bottle in her apron is completely, that would be an understatement.
Yeah.
I mean, I never imagined that about Mormons.
There's an interesting dynamic in your play, Miguel. If you had to say what's the most played out stereotype within Mormonism, it would have to be, for me, the green jello thing. I mean, that's just, we've seen that so many times. But you are actually find within your play some new insights into that. I mean, you take the stereotype and have some fun with it in places that I wouldn't have thought you could get more comic mileage out of that one. But,
well, and I also wondered, too, while you're on that, whether there was a bit of irony here or if it was, this was your first discovery of green jello.
Yeah.
yes, it was actually my first discovery of the Mormon culinary cuisine was actually funeral potatoes. My 97-year-old neighbor, who is an amazing woman, invited my partner and I to dinner one time, and she served them. And I loved them, and she was completely surprised that I had never tasted or eaten funeral potatoes.
So, don't diss funeral potatoes. They're fabulous.
Yes. And so I went and did the research, and that's when the novel came to be. I said, wow, one of my favorite authors is Laura Esquivel. So like Water for Chocolate, I said, I wonder if I could do a Mormon theme, paying homage to like Water for Chocolate novel that would start with recipes all the way through. And that's when I found out about green jello, too.
Yeah.
But if I could say to Miguel's credit, and I think this is where Eric was heading of with the mileage that Miguel got out of this metaphor of Mormon cuisine, and Eric and I talked before the show began, and both of us admitted we haven't seen the play. I tried to see it Sunday night, but it was canceled, which had an odd appropriateness of trying to see a play satirizing Mormons being canceled on Sunday. Of course you can't see it on a Sunday.
Yeah, exactly.
It was Heavenly Father who did it. Air conditioner broke. So they had to 24 hours before they had to cancel, and the early performance luckily was very nice because it was a cold day, but the evening performance the theater was completely musky and
but you get the sense from reading Miguel's script in that he takes this metaphor of a stereotype of Mormon cuisine and he digs somewhat deeper as early as page 2, where the character Wendy talks about how orange carrots didn't exist until the 16th century. Sometimes we think we know nature, people, but we don't. In the end, life is about passing, about pretending to be. Even vegetables can fake who they are. Ellipsis, secrets. Which gives you the sense that Miguel is at some point veering away from stereotypes and into deeper territory about surface appearances and who characters truly really are as people.
Yeah.
let's not be afraid of stereotypes either. Satire mm-hmm. comes out of stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an important part of the conversation, I have to say, because, I mean, Troy has talked about this. I mentioned it in the introduction, the idea that stereotypes serve as reference points. So they're, I mean, you can't throw them away. They're familiarities that get you into a story.
That's exactly right. And comedy comes out of truth. I mean, we laugh when we see something and think, oh, wow, that's why so much stand-up starts with the line, did you ever notice how, and if we've noticed that, we think it's funny. We respond to that. Likewise with stereotypes. There is a funeral potatoes stereotype based on the fact that we've all had them. We've all
and
been to
them.
And loved them.
And loved them. Well, but that kind of leads us to another part of this question, and that is, does there need to be affection underneath it? Should there be a love there, or is it okay to be just completely critical of that culture you're taking down?
Why does the Book of Mormon musical work so well? Why is this a pop culture phenomenon? This is a blasphemous, irreverent show that is making fun of Mormons, but fundamentally at the core of this show is a deep love for Mormonism. And from my own experience working with Charles, developing Dottie Dixon, what was so fantastic from my own personal journey writing and creating with him was that I discovered through that process, Prop 8 had happened, yeah. And there was this history of horrible homophobic rhetoric from the church. And I felt a deep sense of a remembering of what I loved about growing up Mormon. Remembering the primary songs and some of the idioms of the faith, and just really feeling remembering that warm feeling of being surrounded and loved by the church, and that's healed me in a lot of ways from that deep pain. So I think if you want to reach lots of people, you're going to do it more effectively when there's love at the core than just smacking them over the head.
It's more nuanced.
Yeah, I think so.
But if we take the classic example of satire that everyone reads in high school, or at least hopefully even college, Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, which is one of the most scathing examples of satire ever, you couldn't get a more forceful example of a writer trying to reveal the barbarity that resides underneath the facade of civilization. And that work has endured for a long, long time. And that, I think satire, you can turn it up to 11. You can turn it down to 1 or 2, and it can be subtle and playful. You can turn it all the way up to 11. And it can be extremely forceful and extremely biting and scathing. I think there's a whole range.
I absolutely agree with that. We shouldn't just assume as a matter of course that there's a better kind of satire, that a satire that's rooted in affection for its subject isn't somehow morally superior to a satire that's rooted in as with
outrage.
Swift, just outrage. And anger.
And disdain.
Yeah. I mean, does Stephen Colbert like and admire Bill O'Reilly? I don't much care. All I know is that it works, yeah.
Well, what I was really grateful for, and where I knew that Charles and I had succeeded so much, when we did Dottie, this is a Mormon housewife in drag talking about gay issues and the conflict with the church. I thought we'd have the LGBT community filling the houses every night, which we did. But then early in the production, it was just normal, average Mormons coming to the show, BYU professors coming to the show. And all of a sudden we realized that we were actually reaching, not just speaking to the choir, but we were actually reaching people who were really struggling in their wards and in their stakes, and who saw in Dottie, as one mom from Kaysville said to me, I'm Dottie Dixon. I've got a gay son. And now she was discovering a new language through which to deal with this really difficult issue through what was happening on the stage. And so I'm interested as a storyteller in radio or theater or whatever is how do we create a new language for people to discover and work through these very difficult issues? How do we reach out to progressive Mormons? Because God knows this state needs them. We need progressive Mormon feminists and Mormon environmentalists and people who are pro-LGBT in the church to stand up, to speak out, to run for office, to make a difference. And so if this work can inspire them to do that, then we'll all be better because of it.
You know, I think what's interesting is, so Troy is talking about something that I think I got from Charles in our conversation also, this idea that there is not an agenda, I don't want to put it that way, but there is something purposeful about that satire, that you're reaching an end, which is understanding, love, those kinds of things. But let's also mention that there's an awful lot of very good satire but has no agenda in that way, that's just about, you know, taking the air out of the ruling class, showing that to itself.
So scoring points.
Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting question because we see it on the international stage regarding fundamentalist Muslims. If we look back to the outrage over the Muhammad cartoons out of Denmark, everyone in Western society defends the right of a political cartoonist to lampoon the most revered figure of a major world religion. But the question is, did that do anything to bring the Muslim world closer to what we in the West consider as an open society where the free exchange of ideas can flourish without people coming to blows? It would seem that those cartoons didn't accomplish that at all, it's an interesting tension between the individual rights of free expression and how impolite do you want to be, and how much do you care about building bridges or carrying a message across to a larger audience.
Satire has always been a way of measuring how open a community is, you know, to its own shortcomings or.
Yeah. Well, you talked about satire within the world of Islam, and I'm kicking myself because I can't remember the guy's name, but the Egyptian comic, sort of Egyptian John Stewart.
Egyptian John Stewart, yeah, it escapes me too.
I can't remember his name, but that guy's heroic. I mean, that guy's getting arrested and he still does it, and it's serving such a healthy and positive function within Egyptian society. Mm-hmm. Simply because it is pushing the boundaries of freedom of expression of all that First Amendment stuff that we're about.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that the Book of Mormon musical does so well, one of the things that it's satirizing is this sense of religious exceptionalism that Mormons and many faiths are full of. All right, that we are the one true church. We have the answers, and in this play, you know, Elder Price goes to Uganda, and he is going to save these people from the warlords and AIDS and all of these things. And through the process, as the characters evolve and grow, they instead of being going to teach, they go and are taught. And come through it more expansive, more open-minded, more loving, and more compassionate. And I think really that's the trajectory that Mormonism as a faith really needs to go through. And we need to sort of mature and evolve as a people, not be so defensive all the time, but actually become more universal in our approach. And satire, theater, storytelling helps us to open up to those possibilities.
Troy Williams is with us, producer and host of KRCL's Radioactive. We have Ben Fulton here. He covers theater and art for the Salt Lake Tribune. The playwright Eric Samuelson is also with us. Plan B Theater Company is devoting their 2013-14 season to his work, including our radio drama partnership that's coming up in December. We also have Miguel Santana with us, who wrote the play The Righteous and Very Real Housewives of Utah County. And also a novel by the same name. His play opened last week, continues through Sunday at Fort Douglas's Post Theater. We'd also mention that on June 19th, he's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop. You can get all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We would like to hear from you, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how you portray Utah culture in art. Satirizing a faith or building characters around people who live in your community can be tricky. Often the idea is to take the air out of, you know, the silly, puritanical, uptight ruling class. But are there boundaries? And are the old stock characters and themes all that interesting anymore? 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us playwright and writer Miguel Santana. We have playwright Eric Samuelson with us here. We have Troy Williams, radio producer and writer. We have Ben Fulton, who covers theater and art for the Salt Lake Tribune. Let's go to the phones. Anne is with us in Salt Lake. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I just have a question. Salt Lake City is quite diverse, and I think that's the main reason why these plays work as well as they do. But I just have a question for your guests, Troy Williams and the others. Could you feel discomfortable making fun of, let's say, the Muslim community or the Catholics? And if so, why have we not heard of this?
Yeah, this is Troy. I'm happy to jump in there. I was born and raised a Latter-day Saint, a Mormon gay boy from Eugene, Oregon. And this is my story to tell. And I can't speak as freely on Muslim issues. It's just not my story.
It's interesting to note that if you watch some of John Waters' films, and he's a native of Baltimore, which has an extremely large and vibrant Roman Catholic community, I mean, he's pretty unsparing toward Roman Catholics in a lot of his films. And I remember a few years back there was a British film called Four Lions, which pretty much successfully satirized four hapless jihadis who try to hatch these terrorist plots by tying bombs to crows and other mishaps of terrorism that was obviously a direct jibe at Muslim-inspired terrorism or fundamentalist-inspired terrorism. So you see it across the world in communities that have these religious minorities or even their own religious majorities. So it's not altogether unheard of. I think the fact that Mormons are the majority here. When we talk about power, we talked about power earlier. Power is a very wide open target, and everyone pretty much agrees or knows who has the power in our state.
Yeah,
I would look at somebody like Sacha Baron Cohen, who does incredible satire aimed at, among other things, dictators, Muslim dictators, in particular, or Christa Rang.
Which is interesting, coming from a fairly Orthodox Jew.
Yeah. And he has his dictator playing a video game in which you kill the Jews at the Munich Olympics. I mean, he's playing a video game where he's
about taboos.
Yeah, I mean, talk about taboos. It's an incredible scene. And, of course, Cohen's coming out of that faith tradition.
Hold that thought for a moment. I want to get another call in here because I think it's expressing a similar kind of thing, and I want you to work it through. Terrell is joining us in Salt Lake. Terrell, welcome.
Thanks.
Sure.
I had a friend bring her father to town when Saturday's Voyeur was first opening. And she invited him to go, and he said, this is about what, well, she said, it's making fun of the Mormons, and you'll just love it. And he said, I see. If this were making fun of the Jews, would you be going? And then he thanked her very much and said he would not like to go. I'd love your comment on that.
It gets to the same sort of kind of thing. Miguel, or any of the rest of you, I mean, this idea that, look, if you just took out the name Mormon and put in Jew, it would be, to some, remarkably offensive.
Yes, and I agree with that too. But I second what Troy said. You know, this is my story to tell. I grew up LDS. This is the community that I always wanted to live, that I aspire to come to. And it's not my job to do that. My job, when I wrote this play, is I wanted to put something on stage that could be taken somewhere else. And it was my encounter with this culture, the surprises that I found, and the completely, I mean, I really, really was shocked at some point by the what you call stereotypes here that to me were complete, just new characters, new people. And I thought that I grew up, I mean, I became an educator when I was an elementary teacher for a long time. So I took some of these things that I was learning and put them in these issues and put them into the play. This is my story to tell.
Yeah. If I could take issue sometimes with people who say it's not good to make fun of a certain religious group, because it seems the distinction must be made that there are ethnic groups and groups based on race, such as African Americans. There's an ongoing argument about whether Judaism is a religion or an ethnic group or some mix of both. But religion is a set of ideas, and ideas have consequences, and people choose to hold those beliefs or reject those beliefs. And I kind of take issue with every assertion that says that religious beliefs must not be mocked. As an admitted agnostic, I personally hold the belief that all religious beliefs and tenets are somewhat equally ridiculous and unproven. But that's just my opinion. But ideas have consequences, and religious ideas have consequences. And you know, whenever Bernard Shaw wrote Androcles and the Lion, he prefaced it with a very long essay about the future of Christianity, whether or not the tenets of Christianity would survive, whether or not those tenets were true. And no one took that play to be anti-Christian, but Bernard Shaw had the freedom to take issue with certain tenets of Christianity.
You know, it's also interesting as you see the flip side of that you see people, I'm seeing more of this now, people taking on fundamentalism within sort of the atheist community, kind of shrill, uninterested liberals. I mean, you're seeing it's not just doesn't just come from the right, it just doesn't go toward religion. You also see satire taking on sort of other, you know, sides of the spectrum, which I think is interesting these days.
But I think it's really important to keep in mind the power dynamic of satire, that it is a comedic form for powerlessness in the face of powerful people. I think if a bunch of football players are making fun of gay kids prior to beating them up, that's not funny.
Or blackface.
Or blackface. Or part of my doctoral dissertation was about Norwegian theater during the Nazi occupation. And the theaters were allowed to perform, but they were heavily censored. The Nazis had a play contest, and the winning play was going to be staged at the National Theater in Oslo. And the winning play was a play that made fun of Jews. It was a play about in which the Nazis showed absolutely stereotypic Jewish guy destroying the life of an idealistic young German artist. And when you read the text of that play, there's really nothing funny about it. There's nothing moral about it. It's an incredibly offensive and horrendous piece. And the National Theater actors at the time sort of made a compact among themselves that they would every night find a different way to mess up the performance.
Wow.
So one night they were completely inaudible. They just said all their lines so that they couldn't be heard by the audience at all. Another night they just kept forgetting their lines on purpose. Another night, you know, they would destroy props right before coming on stage and using them. And that actually turns out to be kind of an interesting subversion of power. Mm-hmm. But the play itself is not. The play itself, I don't think, qualifies as satire. I think it's powerfulness asserting its prerogatives. Mm.
Yeah. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Here's an email from Matthew Ivan Bennett, as a matter of fact, a local writer, of course, a playwright. Maybe the key to keeping satire fresh is by honoring the democratizing force of comedy, is how he puts it. Good comedy, he writes, doesn't spare anyone from a joke. Good satire doesn't only ridicule one side of a power dynamic, but finds the funny in victimhood, too. Little different spin on you there, Eric, but interesting. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Miriam is with us in Salt Lake. Miriam, welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was just gifted with tickets. I'm excited. But I just joined the church a little over a year ago, and one of the first things I observed was that, you know, for all the talk about oh, we're happy and we have this and the other, was that people really weren't acting and living happy. And I often, and I still do comment, if indeed we have the true answer, and individually I don't know that we have the one and only single true answer, why aren't we happy? Why aren't we enjoying life? Why aren't we doing things to attract people to this religion? And I think that satire, as long as it's not abusive, as long as it's not, I'm also Jewish. My mother was a Holocaust survivor. So the kind of play that they put on in Germany would be entirely offensive. So as long as the play is not offensive in that manner, I think it can send a message that there are better ways to communicate what we're saying, that we need to look at ourselves and see what we're saying in our actions, in our words, in our lives. And I hope that this play does that. I'm excited about seeing it. But I think it's a life lesson that everyone needs to learn, whatever their politics, religion, or anything else.
Yeah. Miriam, glad you called. Thanks very much. Troy?
I really appreciate your call. I think as Mormons, young Latter-day Saints, we're taught to perform our faith the first Sunday of the month in the testimony meeting, which a Mormon testimony kind of has its own three-act structure. You kind of go through this wilderness of faith until you have a crisis and then a road of trials, and then you have an experience that affirms your faith. And we're taught to perform our faith, but we're actually pretty lousy storytellers about our faith because, like the caller said, we have to put on this show of how wonderful everything is. And when you look at the way that Mormonism is understood, the great works of art or literature, I think of they're all done by outsiders or exiled Mormons. How we understand the Mormonism, how the world understands Mormonism, is through Fawn Brody's book, through Tony Kushner's play Angels in America, through Big Love, through the Book of Mormon musical. And I want to know, why is that the case? Why haven't active, faithful Mormons been able to communicate their story in a way that convinces people, in a way that makes people want to hear them and take them seriously? I'm talking to you, Mitt Romney. All right? it's a big problem.
I think there's a lot of censorship, which is self-censorship about what you want to say and put on, in my case, on stage. Having grown up, having family that is active Mormon, having on both sides, my side and my partner's side, you write your play or your script, and then you constantly censor yourself in a way, is this going to hurt them? Mm-hmm. So I think that what you were talking at the beginning is, how do I measure myself, and how do I contain this satire to not go to the point that I don't want to hurt those who I love?
Yeah.
It's hard.
801-585-WEST, again, the number. Back to the phones. Reagan is with us in Cedar City. Reagan, welcome. Reagan, do we have you there? Apparently not, but I love what he had to say. Let me just see if I can paraphrase it based on what I see here on the screen. Reagan says, Mormon satire does not go far enough to make fun of the truly sacred. It doesn't take on, for example, the temple ritual. To compare that to making fun of the Prophet Muhammad, those are the clear lines. So, which raises to me the question, and Miguel, I want to put this to you, because this is something you've sort of dealt with, this question of how far you go. Temple rituals are particularly sacred to Mormons. What's the boundary?
To me, it's love. It's exactly that. And being involved in this community, and being I've been coming to Utah County for 15 years. My in-laws live in Payson, so I know how far I can push. But at the end of the day, I don't need to go to taking the sacred and it's not my sensibility as an author. You know, there are difficult topics in the play. There are there is a young Mormon lady questioning her faith because she has two biracial children, and the fact of the matter is that a lot of plays, the play actually quotes the scripture that refers to these what we consider now racist policies that we used to have, and so it's not that I don't push it, but I push it to from a point of I don't need to show an endowment ceremony. I don't need to. But we can talk about it. Yeah. And we can talk about the meaning of it. So that's probably my boundary.
What do you think? Eric?
You know, that's a terrific question and terrific point that the caller makes. But the power dynamic gets interesting because as theater artists, we are in a position of power in relationship to the audience. We're up there. We're speaking the lines. They're stuck in those seats. They can leave, I suppose, but that's always awkward. And I want to use that power I have as a playwright, as a theater artist, in a way that's responsible and that respects their autonomy, their humanity, their value system. Maybe that makes me too cowardly to be an effective satirist, but
because you're self-censoring for sure.
Because
right?
I am self-censoring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to get into something like the temple ritual, I find myself wondering. The audience members I know who are active LDS people, as I am, would find that immensely offensive and wouldn't come away from the experience with anything afterwards, with any kind of positive message at all.
And so in that sense, it's not worth it to you.
In that sense, it's not worth it to me. Yeah.
But taking the risk is really important, though. One of my favorite moments in the play that I did with Charles Frost, The Passion of Dottie Dixon, is when at the end of the play, she becomes exalted. She becomes a god and her own heavenly mother of her own planets. And as she crosses the veil, she's like, oh, man, I got so nervous. I almost forgot my secret name. Right? And so being able to – you have to be able to laugh. And active Latter-day Saints who can laugh at that kind of stuff and laugh at their own foibles are people who are mature in their faith and who have a really – expansive, inclusive worldview.
I think, the question of it being offensive is just one of the great surprises and adventures of art and literature. When Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, he put the Prophet Muhammad at the very last circle of hell. When Mozart wrote his opera Idomeneo, he has a scene that shows the severed heads of the Prophet Muhammad, Jesus, and Buddha. In everyone's adventures, we remember moments where we think this clearly crosses the line. I remember as a teenager listening to a song by the Sex Pistols called Belson Was a Gas. And deep in your gut when something has crossed the line. But that's the adventure of art, and that's the journey of great art and literature, and it's one of its surprises.
It's Ben Fulton. Covers theater and art for the Salt Lake Tribune. Also with us, Troy Williams, producer and host of KRCL's Radioactive. Playwright Eric Samuelson with us. Plan B Theater Company is devoting their 2013-2014 season to his work. And Miguel Santana, who wrote the play, The Righteous and Very Real Housewives of Utah County, also a novel by that same name. The play opened last week. It continues through Sunday at the Fort Douglas Post Theater. June 13th, he's giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop. He's busy. You can go to the website for the details. RadioWest.KUER.org. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure.
We invite you to go to our website. You can continue the conversation. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Big thanks to our intern, Taylor Almond. We should mention it's his last day with Radio West. He's done terrific work for us, and we're going to miss him. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.